When I got back Friday, my brother-in-law was in the ICU because he found out he had diabetes and didn't know. And his blood sugar levels were 40 milligrams away from being in a coma. So I ended up dog sitting for my sister because she was at the hospital with them. And then I kind of got out sick of COVID. And then Sunday, I saw a package. There's an alpaca farm, apparently, where I live, and they do the twice a year, they open it to the public. I got yarn from the alpaca farm. I was going to make a tiny one, and I guess I got it.
Okay, welcome back. So first thing on the agenda today, I want to see about scheduling the second exam. Now, sometime during the week before spring break, I said that the exam was going to be this week, but I think that's too ambitious. So what I'm proposing is to have the second exam a week from today. Then the plan will be today to remind you of what went on just before we went on spring break. I'll quickly run through this stuff until we get up to vector space isomorphisms. But then I'm going to switch gears. The next topic, general vector spaces, will actually help us prepare for the exam. Because what I'm going to do is effectively generalize all the constructs, subspaces, linear transformations, various subspaces associated with matrices, all that stuff, I can show you how it's actually applied in general applications once we cover the topic of general vector spaces. So I'll introduce that today, and I'll probably spend Wednesday just talking about examples of general vector spaces. So you see how all the apparatus that we've developed since the first midterm, how it can be applied. So it's going to be this material on general vector spaces. It's not going to be covered explicitly on the exam, but my hope is that it's close enough to the topics that were covered on the exam that anyway it will be a study aid for the second exam. And then what we would do on Friday is I'll do a general review session that will maybe we'll run through a practice second exam on Friday, and that I think will leave you pretty well prepared for a second exam a week from today. So any questions on that? Okay, so I'm going to tentatively schedule the exam a week from today. If you guys, if I get a bunch of emails saying I have an engineering exam on that day, can we please consider moving it? I will consider it, but because a week away is just a week away, I want to announce the exam today. And if we need to reschedule because of conflicts, then we can adjust that on Wednesday. But anyway, that would still be an exam a week later than your first notice of the exam. Okay, so any questions on that? Yeah.
I'm actually gonna get back from my regional trip on Monday morning. Is there any way I can take it Wednesday?
You could take it if you're getting back Monday morning. You could take it with my afternoon class. That would be convenient. Okay. Okay, so let me start. So the main thing that we focus on just prior to our well-deserved break was functions between vector spaces and their associated subspaces. So right after the first exam, we introduced matrices and then simultaneously subspaces. And subspaces were attached to matrices by looking at the span of their columns, the span of their rows, or the solution set of an associated linear system. What I want to do today is go through similar stuff, but now it's dealing with linear transformation rather than matrices. But one of the first things I'll show you on the next slide is that linear transformations are naturally associated with subspaces. And in fact, from a calculational point of view, if you understand how to find subspaces for matrices, then you also can find the corresponding subspaces for linear transformations. And I'll work through that material until they get to the point of vector space isomorphisms. These are going to be linear transformations between vector spaces, so functions that take you from one vector space to another. But to be an isomorphism, there's yet another additional condition, and that is that the function should be invertible. So not only can you go from one vector space to another, but you can return to the original vector space by applying an inverse function. That idea is going to be useful when we talk about general vector spaces, because what we're going to find is that a general vector space is anyway going to be isomorphic to one of the RNs, our calculational vector spaces. And so once we introduce general vector spaces, the use of isomorphism actually will take these general vector spaces into a calculational setting. Okay, so let's see. All right, so a linear transformation is a function between two vector spaces that's compatible with our fundamental vector space operations of scalar multiplication and vector addition. These guys can naturally be associated with matrices, and the correspondence goes both ways. If you start off with a matrix with n rows and n columns, you can create a function that goes from a m-dimensional vector space to an n-dimensional vector space simply using matrix multiplication. So what you see by this formula here is that if A is an n by m matrix, it can multiply a column vector with m rows. So this matrix multiplication would be defined, and it would produce, so here you get the necessary match, the dimension of the vector that's kicked out is going to be n by 1. So you can think of this as going from m-dimensional vectors to n-dimensional vectors. And indeed, the function defined in that way is first and in fact most important example of a linear transformation. This function is going to satisfy these properties automatically, just going to reduce the properties of matrix multiplication. But you can also go in the opposite way as well. If you have a function between two vector spaces that satisfies these two rules, then you can create a matrix that can implement the action of this function simply via matrix multiplication. Here's how you produce that matrix. If T is going from an m-dimensional vector space to an n-dimensional vector space, well, then you can use the standard basis vectors for the domain. So this E1 is the vector, the standard basis vector, where the only non-zero component is the first component, and similarly for the last one. You just apply the function to the standard basis vectors. That gives you an n-dimensional vector that you write as a column. So if you fill this thing out by explicitly seeing how this function acts on the standard basis vectors, you're going to get an n by m matrix, calling that AT. And what this matrix has the property of is that T of x can be replaced by AT of x. That is, you could compute the action of this function simply by using matrix multiplication. Okay, so matrix define linear transformations, and linear transformation define matrices. So they're fairly equivalent to one another. And in fact, when we talk about subspaces related to matrices, there's going to be a corresponding subspaces corresponding to linear transformations. So here are the two subspaces that are of interest when we look at functions between vector spaces. One is first subspace consists of looking at all the points in the codomain that can be reached by applying the function. Well, here's the precise mathematical statement. The range of T is a subset of vectors inside Rn, so they're living in here, but they all have to be reachable by applying your function to some element of your domain. And it turns out And we showed this, I guess in the preceding lecture, was that the range of this, of a linear transformation can be computed by first calculating its associated matrix, and then determining the column space of that matrix. And let me remind you, for a matrix A, you get a basis for the column space of the matrix by row reducing A to a row echelon form and grabbing the columns of the original matrix A by that correspond to the columns of the row echelon form that have pivots of the long row echelon form that contain pivots. Okay, so that's how we actually end up calculating this range. We construct the matrix. It's on the preceding slide. We construct this matrix, and then we row reduce that matrix to row echelon form, figure out where the pivots live, go back to the original matrix, and use those as the generators of this subspace, range of T. All right, and then a second subspace. So this range is a subspace of the codomain. The kernel of T is a subspace of the domain, and it consists of all the vectors in the domain that get sent to the zero vector. So that's not the number zero. That's the zero vector inside the codomain, or N. So it's going to be the vector where you have N zeros. All right, and that's this is a subspace, and what it's actually computable as the null space of the associated matrix. In other words, it's the solution set of the corresponding matrix used as a coefficient matrix of a linear, homogeneous linear system. Okay, so those are two important subspaces that one can attach to a matrix. And part of the utility of this is that I'll show you later that if the range of T is in fact the entire codomain, and the kernel of T consists of only the zero vector inside the domain, then in fact you know that that linear transformation has an inverse. That was the main point of the lecture just prior to today's lecture. Let me point out a couple other salient facts that came from before our discussion, before spring break. If we have an n by n matrix, remember the number of columns of A, that's equal to the rank of A plus the nullity. So here I'm just reminding you of some definitions. The rank of A, well, that's the dimension of the row space, which turns out to be exactly the same as the dimension of the column space. So what's striking here is that this row space, we have an n by n matrix. Each row is going to have exactly m entries. So this is actually a subspace of Rm. While the column space of A, that's the set of all linear combinations of the column vectors, but the column vectors are going to have n entries or n rows. So that's a subspace of Rn. So the surprising fact is that these two subspaces live in different vector spaces, yet they have the same dimension, which what really means is that the number of vectors you need to create a basis in either of these cases is the same. But the reason why we know it's the same is the way we find bases for these two subspaces. So the rank of either one of these numbers, if you just count the number of basis vectors you get for the row space, it's going to be the number of non-zero rows you have in a row echelon form of A. Well, that's going to be the same as the number of columns of the row echelon form that have pivots, because a non-zero row is going to have a non-zero first entry. Here, the rule for getting the basis vectors for the column space is you again look at the row echelon form of A, you figure out where the pivots live, and then you go back to the original matrix, and you grab the corresponding columns. But the number of columns you grab depends on how many pivots you have in your row echelon form. So both these numbers, now the number of vectors you get is going to be the same because they both correspond to pivots in the row echelon form. Then similarly, the null space of a matrix, well, that's the dimension of the null space of a matrix is called a nullity. It's the dimension of, well, the null space is a solution set of a linear system. And oops, this is coming off page. It's equal to the number of free parameters in the solution set. The dimension of that solution set basically just going to equal the number of free parameters. But number of free parameters is the number of columns without pivots. And so this observation here, this theorem, is just based on the counting of pivots. The rank is columns with pivots in the row echelon form. The dimension of the null space is equal to the number of columns without pivots. Well, when I combine these two, I get the total number of columns of the matrix. And so that's how that identity pops out. But what that identity also tells us is a relationship between the dimensions of subspaces attached to a linear transformation. And that is that the range of a linear transformation, subspace over here, of all the points that are reachable by applying the linear transformation, we take the dimension of that subspace and we add to it the dimension of all the vectors in the domain that get sent to the zero vector over here. Well, those two numbers have to add up to the dimension of the domain. And that's because both the range of T and the kernel of T can be computed in terms of the associated matrix. And here's the count we did on the preceding slide, where we have columns of a row echelon form that have pivots and columns of row echelon form that don't have pivots, but these two numbers add up to the total number of columns. On the other hand, the column space of this matrix is exactly equal to the range of T, and the null space of this matrix is exactly equal to the kernel of T. And so this identity pops out. Okay, so I'll remind you again that the reason for looking at the range and kernel is that it's going to tell us when a given linear transformation can be inverted. When can I not only go from Rm to Rn, but when can I follow that back to the take vectors from Rn and map them back to the original domain Rm? All right, so I'm going to a statement I didn't put on the slides, but I want to, it's a result from last time. We had a linear transformation T from Rm to Rn is invertible if, well, by definition, it means that if there exists a function t to the minus first that takes you in the opposite direction from Rn to Rm, and you want this to be such that t composed with t to the minus first just is the identity function on this argument, and that t to the minus first composed with t Maybe I should have written it this way. Y and x equals x. So y is going to be an element of Rn, and x is going to be an element of Rm. But either way, you compose these, either t composed with t to the minus first or t to the minus first composed with t. They just, that composition always produces the identity function that takes a given vector to itself. So that's what it means to have an inverse. And what I showed you last time is that t from Rm to Rn is invertible if and only if two conditions hold. One is you need the range of t to equal the entire codomain. And the second of all thing you need is you need the kernel of your linear transformation. That has to consist of only the zero vector inside the domain. So the subspace really only consists of the zero vector. So this was the theorem that we proved before. And invertible linear transformations are called isomorphisms. So another way of saying that is that a linear transformation is an isomorphism if these two hold. And what that will mean is that we can pass back and forth between our two vector spaces because if we have an isomorphism, we know that the inverse function actually exists. Okay, now what I want to do, that much is review of what we covered just prior to spring break. What I want to do is sort of build on these topics by moving a little bit forward in the course. We're now going to consider vector spaces over sets that might not be ordered lists of numbers, but somehow are going to behave like Rn, our standard vector space. So what we're going to need for this is, first of all, a set of objects, and just think of them as objects, not as vectors yet. We need some set containing a bunch of objects. And what we need to be able to do to put a vector space structure on this set is to have some notion of scalar multiplication, meaning we have a rule for taking a number and an element of our set and then producing a new set. That takes a number and a vector and produces the scalar multiple, this new vector that sits in, well, this new object that sits inside that set. And similarly, for every pair of objects in this set, we have a rule that will map pairs of elements of V to a new element of V that still lives inside V itself. And so you can think of this scalar multiplication as a function that takes a number and a vector and produces a new vector, and vector addition is a function that takes two vectors and produces a new function. But this is sort of the setup for a vector space over R. What we also impose to get a bona fide vector space over the real numbers is to demand that these two operations actually satisfy eight distinct axioms that are quite natural consequences when our vector spaces is just order lists of numbers, but now we're extending the ideas of Rn to this new setting. So what we want is, just like vectors and order lists of numbers, when we add three of the objects in a set V using its rule for vector addition, it shouldn't make any difference when we need to sum three vectors, whether we sum the first two first and then the last vector, or if we add the first vector to the sum of the last two vectors in order to do that computation of three vectors. Our rule for adding vectors only works for two vectors. And so if we're going to add three vectors, there's two ways of doing it. And the statement is that it doesn't make any difference how we actually combine three vectors via vector addition. Secondly, we want the multiplication commutative, so the order in which we add things doesn't make any difference. We want a zero vector, a vector that lives inside the set, such that when we add it to any other vector inside the set, we get back what we started off with. Furthermore, we're going to want, for every vector in V, we're going to want sort of an additive inverse, a vector such that when I add it to a given vector, I always get the zero vector as a result. We need scalar multiplication. We need that to distribute over to vector addition. So this would be true if U and V were numbers, but here they're just objects of a set. And so this is something, given a rule for scalar multiplication, that would have to be verified. This short associates compatibility of the rule for adding objects is compatible with the rule for scalar multiplying objects in a natural way. And similarly, if we add two numbers together before multiplying, we ought to be able to delay that addition until afterwards. But notice here, I'm adding numbers, while on the right-hand side, I'm adding vectors. So there is something, there is some content to this formula. It's not just distributing. Well, we have to postulate that that distributive rule actually holds. And then we have a natural way of doing multiple scalar multiplications. If I do two scalar multiplications in a row, that could be carried out by multiplying the two factors together first and then doing the scalar multiplication. And then lastly, that last statement is sort of off screen, is that when you multiply, scalar multiply an object in your set D by the number one, you get back what you started off with. Now, in the case of the vectors inside Rn, each of these identities is trivially verified. I may do a couple of those on the next slide. But the point of these axioms is if we have any set D with some notion of scalar multiplication and some notion of vector addition, effectively it's going to behave exactly like one of our familiar vector spaces, Rn. And in fact, the whole apparatus that I've been developing so far is just so that we can take abstract vector spaces and bring them to a calculational setting. It's where, so in fact, in the end, the way we deal with these general vector spaces is by transporting questions about them into the questions inside Rn where we can do calculations, and then we'll take the answer back. Yeah?
So this object V is our abstract vector space?
Yeah, it's an abstract vector space. And I'll give you some examples so you see how what it means to be an abstract vector space. Right now, our familiarity, and I've really stressed this since the start of the course, is thinking of vectors as ordered lists of numbers, because that's what our calculations are based upon. But now what I'm proposing now is we'll consider other sets other than ordered lists of numbers, but the calculational apparatus that we've been developed will be able to be applied to these more general situations. All right, so let me give you some examples. So the first one, first thing, if this were a proof course, one of the homework assignments I would make is that in each of the examples, verify that all eight axioms hold. But I'm not going to do that because there's a lot of axioms to check, and I actually have five distinct examples as well. And I'm not going to do 40 demonstrations of trivial rules, but I do want to show you at least how you would start verifying these eight axioms in practice. What you need is a rule for doing the scalar multiplication, a rule for vector addition, so some way of taking an element in your set and a number and producing a new element, that would be scalar multiplication, some way of combining two elements of the set to create a new element, and that to be interpreted as vector addition, and last thing you need in order to satisfy this third axiom is you need a zero vector inside your vector space. But once you have this data, once you've decided what the zero vector is and what scalar multiplication, what vector addition is, then it's just a matter of sitting down with a pad of paper and making sure that these axioms are all satisfied. All right, so let's start with the basic example. where our vector space is a set of ordered lists of numbers. And then scalar multiplication is defined. Here's a number and an ordered list of numbers, and here's a new ordered list of numbers. So that defines scalar multiplication, vector addition, and the zero vector. These are things we've been using throughout the course. All right, now, next example shows you why I was so interested in subspaces. First of all, because subspaces take place, at least up to this point in the course, they always take place as special sets of vectors inside a set of ordered lists of numbers, right? So if you have a subspace of Rn, what it is, it's a set of vectors that live in here, but to be a subspace, it has to be closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. So as soon as you have a subspace of Rn, you know that these two properties hold. And in fact, these two properties, what they will do for us now is they will serve to find a notion of scalar multiplication and vector addition that occurs on V rather inside of Rn. The way we get those rules, the way we get a rule that takes a number and a vector and produces another vector inside this abstract set V is, well, we can just take the rules inside Rn and just restrict them to vectors that live inside the subset V. Because it's a subset, I know that if I take a number and a vector, I can scalar multiply inside Rn and get another vector. But it also lives inside V. So I can take a number and a vector and get a vector in V. That will be my notion of scalar multiplication in V. But all it is the scalar multiplication in the original vector space Rn that's been restricted to this the subset of the domain. So the domain of scalar multiplication in Rn is R cross Rn, but now I just restrict to R cross the subset V of Rn. And similarly, because when I add two vectors in V, because V is a subspace, I always end up in V. That furnishes me with a map from V to V, V cross V to V. And that will be my notion of vector addition that now I can regard as working purely inside the vector space V, inside the subspace V. And moreover, if you have a subspace, one thing we know about subspaces is they always must contain the zero vector of the vector space in which they live. And so we can just grab the zero vector here, it automatically lives inside our subspace V, and we can use that as the zero vector for V. So now I've got a set, it's actually a subset of Rn, that's for which I have operations of scalar multiplication and vector addition and a zero vector all defined. And what one would then do is verify that all eight axioms of a vector space are satisfied by these notions of scalar multiplication and vector addition and this zero vector. Yeah.
So it has like R and then XV and then VXV. Is that X a multiplication or is that?
Oh, so and yeah, I'm just trying to distinguish between where I put this subscript here. So that's supposed to be I'm thinking of star as going from real numbers cross Rn and producing a vector inside Rn. That's usual scalar multiplication in Rn. And the rule is that lambda times x1 to xn is lambda x1 to lambda xn. And similarly, we have vector addition inside Rn. So it takes two vectors and it produces another vector. Now distinct from this situation is when I have a subset of vectors inside Rn that's actually a subspace. What I want to do is I want to define analogs of scalar multiplication and vector addition appropriate to this new subspace. So there's got to be maps that take me from numbers and elements of the subspace to elements of the subspace, or takes pairs of elements in the subspace and produces a new subspace. That's how I'm going to define these two functions that are going to be interpretable as scalar multiplication in V and vector addition in V. So that's why I put those subscripts. See, I want to distinguish this from the two basic operations that are living in the sort of parent state, parent vector space Rn. So yeah, so that's the reason for the subscripts. And in fact, here you notice that I usually denote zero vectors by simply a bold font zero, but now I have to worry about which vector space that zero vector is living in. So I'm sometimes putting subscripts in to make that clear. Okay, so this zero vector, it actually sits inside here, but subspaces always contain the zero vector of the vector space in which they live. So it also lives in D, and then I can use this guy as the zero vector inside the set because it's an element of the set and it's going to act like zero with respect to vector addition. All right, now what's nice about this, the fact that subspaces are an example of vector spaces, is a lot of the development in the course, for example, my whole spiel that took me several weeks talking about bases and subspaces is now going to be more relevant because we worked hard to find bases for subspaces because they allowed us to coordinatize subspaces. Well, we have a subspace. We can usually figure out what vectors are living in that subspace anyway. We either solve some equations or we look at the span of the set of vectors. But now when we're dealing with abstract vector spaces, subspaces provide sort of a non-trivial example of how do you find good coordinates for a subspace. That question is now going to, or the answer to that question, how do we find a good set of coordinates for a subspace, is now going to have application as how do we find good coordinates for an abstract vector space. And so so this is sort of nice, is that we not only have the basic example of a vector space since the start of the course, but another example of a general vector space is simply a subspace of a vector space. And so we're already somewhat familiar with dealing with vector spaces that are distinct from Rn. All right, so now let's do some more obtuse examples. Here's a real principal one, and probably the reason why you're in this course. We do require calculus in this course, but you notice we don't do any differentiation or integration or anything like that. What we really require it for is a certain amount of functional or mathematical sophistication to know that functions, you can use them and you can create a set of functions. If you're taking differential equations, you're often interested in set of functions that satisfy differential equations. So sets of functions are going to be really common in your applications. And what I want to show you now is how to interpret such a set, nowhere close to an ordered list of numbers, how we nevertheless regard it as a vector space. Well, what we need is a set, some notion of scalar multiplication. So here what I'm suggesting is that if I have a number lambda and a function on the real line, that I can create a new function. I'll label it lambda f, but it's going to be defined by the fact that its value at an arbitrary point x is just the value of f at that point times the parameter lambda, or times the number lambda. And similarly, I can add two functions. If f is a function between r and r and g is a function between r and r, I can create a new function that maps from real numbers to real numbers by simply taking the values of these component functions and adding them together to get the value of the sum f plus g at x. And then the last thing we need to establish a vector space on this set is we need some sort of zero vector. something that when we add it to another vector, always just reproduces that vector. So what I want is a function g that would have the property that when I add it to any function f, I get back that function f. And that can be such a function would be the zero function. The function whose value at any x is always equal to zero. So it's just a constant function where the for all x, the value of the function is equal to zero. And then that function is going to have the property f of zero plus any function g. Let's evaluate it at a point x. Well, according to this rule, this would be f zero evaluated x plus g evaluated x. But if this is the function f zero is defined to be zero for all values of x, this is going to be zero plus g of x is going to equal g of x. So this function added to any function in this set just reproduces that function g. And so here I've verified the existence of an additive identity inside this set. It just happens to be the trivial function where the value at any point is just equal to zero. And in fact, not only do we have an additive identity for this set with these operations and this zero vector, they're going to satisfy all eight axioms. That can be verified by simply working out the details by hand. All right, so now we're really talking about an abstract vector space. Don't really correspond to directions or order lists of numbers or quantities with magnitude and direction. That's something completely different in this example. Yet it's very, very prominent in your applications. Here's another one. In this rendition of a vector space, I want you to think even outside the context of mathematics. I simply want you to imagine a vibrating string. And so it's something, a vibrating string, we can actually treat as a vector. How can we do so? Well, scalar multiplication. Now, first of all, we have this set, all the vibrational modes, say a piano wire or a violin string. We have all its vibrational modes, but we can send a vibrational mode to a new vibrational mode by changing its amplitude, by rescaling the displacement of the corresponding vibrations. And if you do that by a positive factor, that will just change the amplitude. But you can also in addition, you can multiply by negative numbers where the factor of minus one is interpreted as reversing the phase. So in general, you have some vibration going on. If you do scalar multiplication by a positive number, all that will do is change the amplitude. Sorry, this should follow the path of this, but it changes the amplitude of the vibration. So that way, multiplication by a positive number, multiplication by a negative number would have an addition. This would get converted to, well, this would be minus. This is V, then minus V would be the vibration that where instead of having a hilltop here, you have a valley of the same displacement from the horizontal axis. So you can implement these. You can implement these by instructions to your orchestra to be loud or soft. This is harder to pull off within an orchestra. Although if you have guitar players, they often have a switch that they can use to switch the phase of their signal. But these can be implemented purely physically, not with any intervening mathematics. And vector addition, well, if you have two vibrations, You can often hear them simultaneously. And in fact, that's the way we would consider vibrational modes to be added, is they occur simultaneously. And then the zero vector, well, that would just correspond to the string. It's just silence, string being at rest. You would get that by, for example, scalar multiplying by the number zero. And what you take a function and you multiply by zero, you just get the zero function. All right, so there's an example of a physical situation where we can define notions of scalar multiplication, vector addition, and even a zero vector with no intervening mathematics, except for the size of these scalar factors. And then here's another example, polynomials of, say, of degree n. So we have scalar multiplication. What is it? Well, it's the same way we always multiply scalar polynomials. We just multiply all the coefficients in each term by a common factor, lambda. That would be scalar multiplication. And we know how to add polynomials. We just collect together the coefficients of the same power of x, and then we can add them together. And either way, if we think of a polynomial as just being an expression where we have certain numbers times distinct powers of x, what we're getting for both these operations is new polynomials created from old polynomials, either by this scalar multiplication or this vector addition. And the zero vector, well, that would be the zero polynomial where all coefficients are equal to zero. So now what you've seen are five different sets that are functionally are going to behave exactly like Rn. And in fact, this is probably the first course where you've actually seen mathematics as mathematics. In calculus, you take calculus because you need to know how to compute derivatives, and you need to know how to compute integrals, because that's what your applications need. But what you see in this course is we've gotten up to this course. We're over halfway through the course, and I'm introducing how you're going to use it after the course. Because what I had to do prior to introducing the calculations that you're going to use, I had to introduce the language where these calculations take place. And the big surprise is that abstract sets, if you have, vibrational modes of a string, or the states of a hydrogen atom or other things, these are abstract sets that naively you don't see how to calculate. What's going to be important is be able to take these abstract vector spaces, bring them into the calculational setting of Rn, where we can actually do calculations and make predictions, and then we go back. But that calculation, it's true, it's an important part of linear algebra, and we spent the first half of the course describing how to do calculations. But now we have all that in our hand now, and now we can actually apply them to the more general setting for which this course is supposed to teach you. All right, so the main thing to remember at this stage of the game is that while we're widening the arena over which we can apply linear algebra, in the end, this Rn is going to remain fundamental, because even when we're looking at more general vector spaces, the idea for doing concrete calculation is going to take that general vector space and somehow realize it inside these calculational vector spaces Rn. All right, so I guess I only have 2 minutes left. Before I actually show you how we do calculations in general vector spaces, I was going to run through the definitions that we've already seen for Rn and show you how they're modified in this new setting. And effectively, they're not modified much at all. All I have to do is everywhere I see an Rn in the preceding definitions, I replace it by a general vector space D, and we have exactly the same definitions. So for example, a subspace of a general vector space is a subset of that vector space that's closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. Meaning the same thing as it did inside Rn, except now W is going to be a subspace of a subset of an abstract vector space rather than Rn. But it's the same two conditions, compatibility with scalar multiplication and vector addition. We have a set of elements living inside a general vector space. Then we can create a subspace by simply taking all possible linear combinations of them. And that indeed is going to be a subspace of an abstract vector space. We have a set of vectors inside a general vector space. We'll continue to call them linearly independent as if they were living inside Rn, meaning that the only way they can sum to the zero vector inside this abstract vector space is by taking all the coefficients equal to zero. And finally, maybe this is enough for today, a basis for a subspace of a general vector space is simply a set of vectors such that you can reach every point in the vector space by taking linear combinations of these guys, and such that these vectors are linearly independent, meaning they have this property. The only way they add to zero is by taking all the coefficients equal to zero. So what's going to happen now is that simply by replacing Rn by a general vector space D, for which scalar multiplication, vector addition, and zero vector has been defined, we can replicate all the theory. All the theory we had about Rn is going to carry over into this new setting, including the definitions by simply modifying the vector, the name of the vector space we're working with. Okay, so I'll stop here. And what I hope to do on Wednesday is show you how, for example, subspaces and calculating null spaces of matrices or null spaces are kernels of linear transformation, how that all looks inside this new setting, this new framework.